Thank you. I'm Bob, still an alcoholic. Oddly enough, we're coming to the steps that incur forgiveness of ourselves. I think the hardest step for me in Alcoholics Anonymous was step 8 and 9. I almost left AA over it. It just seemed so big. All the people I'd owed money to. I was just talking to a gal in Vegas a couple weeks ago, and she had the same experience. All the guys that she had lived with and took money from and used, and all the jobs that she had shorted and stolen from, and on and on and on. And when she looked at her amends, she wanted to leave AA. And she'd heard me share in a ninth step workshop one time about that, and she said she thought maybe she could try to chip away at this. But it's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But with most of us, when you look, because when it says in our book that we go through people's lives like a tornado, and then all of us, and you get away with a lot of that stuff because you don't get it. You're just so wrapped up in yourself, you don't even see the effect you're having on other people. And then you start to awaken, and it's very painful. Years ago, I sponsored a guy who had HIV, and it was back in the days before HIV. They didn't know what to do with AIDS patients, and he would get really sick. And they didn't have an HIV unit in the hospital in Las Vegas, so they'd put him on the burn unit because it was sterile and, you know, it was safe. And I would go in to visit him, and the most amazing thing I would see in there, I'd go in one day, and you'd see somebody that would be wheeling in, and they looked horrible. They were burns all over their body, but they didn't seem to be in that much pain. And then the next day or the day after, man, they're wailing in pain. And I was talking to this nurse one time, and she said, what happens is it burns off initially the nerve endings, and you don't even know you don't feel the pain initially. And then as you start to heal is when it starts to hurt. And that's when those nurses in there will come to those patients and say, you know, we know you hurt, and we're going to give you this, we're going to do this, but that means that you're getting better. Your nerves are actually growing back. And I think as I started to wake up to a lot of the damage I'd done in my life, I was overwhelmed. It was very, very painful. And I think that my experience with step 8 as a newcomer would be very much like the experience of a kid, say, in the fourth grade looking at the tests he would have to pass in order to graduate from high school. Kid in the fourth grade looking at the tests a senior has to take is going to look at those tests and want to quit school because he doesn't even understand the questions, for God's sakes. It's hopeless. It seems hopeless. But a funny thing happens is that if he keeps showing up for school every day and does his homework and everything he's supposed to do, by the time he gets to the end of the 12th grade, he has everything in place within him to do what he at one time could not do. And that's the synchronistic effect of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a thing that permeates AA. We refer to it as God's grace. Carl Jung called it synchronicity. And that what that is that it becomes evident that you need to fix something that can't be fixed. It becomes evident that you're at point A and you need to go to point B and you can't. There's an abyss between you. You'll never get there. And from the moment of desire, the universe starts rearranging itself to make what was impossible possible. And that was my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous with step 8. And my misgivings about step 8 and feelings about them are part of our history. They go back to the very first days of AA. As a matter of fact, in a sense, Alcoholics Anonymous was founded on Dr. Bob's 8th step. You know, in Mother's Day weekend, 1935, Bill Wilson, 12-step Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob fell in love with the whole program, wanted to do it all. except that amends part. Didn't like that. He said to Bill, he said, I like the spiritual stuff. I like the confession of the shortcomings, the helping others. I like all that. But this amends thing, you know, I've been a doctor in this community. My reputation's bad enough. Let's just leave that alone. And he wouldn't do it. And consequently, he drank again. And he came off of that drunk. He was coming back from a medical convention in Atlantic City. He was so drunk on the train, he'd been on just a round-the-clock jag, that the conductor didn't know what to do with him. So they just laid him on the platform at the Akron station. He was just like comatose. He was my kind of drunk. I like Dr. Bob. I identify with Bill Wilson's sobriety, but I like Dr. Bob's drinking. I drank a lot like that. Anyway, his office manager, nurse, office manager, whatever, came down and rest got him and tried to help him get back on his feet. He was just out of it. Eventually took him home to Ardmore Street where Bill Wilson was still living, and his wife and Bill was trying to take care of him. And he came to on what most historians believe was the morning of June 10th, 1935, early in the morning, shaken. You know how bad, almost a week drunk, just vibe, drinking around the clock, shaken, wanting to jump out of his skin. He says, what morning is it? And they say, it's June 10th. And he goes, oh, my God, it can't be June 10th. I have a surgery to perform the morning of June 10th. And he was a proctologist, so you can use your imagination what kind of surgery it was. And he's like this. Man, he's like this. Imagine being the patient, laying there waiting for your doctor, coming in like this. And Bill Wilson didn't know what to do. He thought, man, I can't let this guy perform surgery like that. So he gave him some pills and a bottle of beer, sent him into the surgery to calm his nerves. So, and the surgery was over pretty quick, actually. We don't know what happened to the patient. A guy died last year, Bill Pittman. He was an archivist and historian. He went back to Akron and searched the hospital records, never could find it. Wanted to find out what happened. All we know from AA literature is he lived. We don't know what happened. I mean, did he whistle when he walked or what? We don't know. But Dr. Bob got out of that surgery still early in the morning, June 10th, 1935, and disappeared. And Bill and Ann, Bob's wife, thought that he went on a tear. You know, I can understand it. My God, Bill had to give him sedatives and a beer. He probably thought, oh, there he goes. But he didn't come home all that morning, all that afternoon, all that evening, and almost midnight. I remember hearing his son tell me, sitting in my house telling the story of this. And about midnight, his dad came home and something was different. And he hadn't been drinking. What he did is he was out searching out everybody he was afraid to face. And consequently, Dr. Bob Smith never took another drink again the rest of his life. And low estimates is that Dr. Bob personally helped over 5,000 alcoholics who helped people who helped people who helped people who helped people. And I bet you we're all in this room down line from Dr. Bob Smith in one way or the other. And we are alive today because one man finally was willing to walk through his fears, put himself aside and face some things he was never able to face before. And it's not easy. You know, Polly referred to Father Ed Dowling's quote in the 12 by 12 in step 6, is that this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I know what he's talking about. And I think that's probably right. But this was really the step that was whether I was going to stay here or not. Treatment centers have bastardized a saying in AA when it says we're willing to go to any lengths. It comes from page 76, and it's referring to amends. It's referring to the eighth step prayer. And it says towards the – it's a couple points in this paragraph. It says, where do you get your eighth step list from? Well, it says we made it when we took inventory. So it comes right off, you know, all those resentments, all those people you think you owed, they owed you amends? Guess what? all the creditors you're afraid to face and the people you hurt that you got to think you got away with it, all the people that you feel shame and guilt over when you think of what you did to them, all those people that incur fear of karma, retribution, people finding out, whatever, they all go on. All the sexual, all the people that got hurt as a result of your drive not to be alone and fill your own vacancies in the sexual arena, they all go on your eight-step list. And at the bottom of that paragraph, in the middle of 76, it says, if we haven't the will to do this, and that's pretty normal. There were people on my eight-step list originally when I first got sober that I was absolutely convinced were going to either kill me or at the very least, if they were having a kindly day, take a baseball bat to me. I was facing 2 years in a state penitentiary if I faced that. I had amends to a family that I could never, they wouldn't even take my calls. It seemed impossible what I'd done to them. It says, if you haven't the will to do this, in other words, if my self-centered fear is greater than my desire for recovery, which is often the case, self-centered fear is strong, then I must bring God into the deal, as I must bring God into everything from step three on. God's part of the deal. And the prayer is I ask for the will to do this. I ask not just once, I ask until it comes. So I can't just say, oh, God, give me the will, and I'm never going to think about that again. No, I ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. This is what any lengths mean. How did that get changed into, if you're willing to go to any lengths, you're willing to try not to drink and go to meetings? How did that happen? That's not what they're talking about. Are you willing to walk through your fears? Are you willing to face the people, the institutions, the people that might lock you up? Are you willing to face the people that you owe money to and take your money, which is not like you have enough? I always thought, I'll pay those people back one day. I hit the lottery one day. And they made me pay it back nickel and a dime at a time. Took years and years and years. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. And I tell you something, I think that this is the step that makes the difference. A lot of people drink again because they have amends that they've swept under the rug, or they refuse to make, or I'm not until they make amends to me first, that kind of thing. Or they're too self-involved to pay back the money because they think they need it more than the people that they're paying. And inevitably, one of two things happens. They sabotage their own sobriety unconsciously. Or sometimes they drink again. I get guys from time to time that are sober 15, 20 years that have made a lot of money in sobriety, and they got this big hole inside of them. And the more money they make, the more in debt they get. Making more money than they can incur debt, they never have a sense of spiritual material well-being. Page 127, there's a promise in here. And I think this is right with step 8 and 9. Right smack in the middle of the page. And it talks about, although financial recovery is on the way for many of us, we found we could not place money first. Tell you something else we can't place first: ourselves. For us, material well-being always followed spiritual progress. It never preceded it. I know a guy who's drinking right now who makes probably... last year he made $150 million. His average, and that was a special year, his average income is about $40 million a year. And he has no material well-being, none. He's obsessed with it. He's worried about it. There's no peace in his life. And it's so bad that he's back to drinking and he's refused to make amends. Because those SOBs really screwed me. I don't need to make amends to them. Owns, 8 or 10 casinos around the world. Has everything. Ferrari, a couple Porsches, $9 million home. And he'll probably be dead within a year. But I'll tell you, they'll give him a hell of a funeral. Material well-being always follows spiritual progress. I know a guy right now in Las Vegas, he's probably making over $1 million a year, and he's driven, and he blows it on stuff as fast as he gets it. No material well-being. Because he put the money first. And you know, a lot of us know that from the hard way. I think that's the number one lesson from the school of hard knocks. That if it ain't no good in here, it ain't no good. No matter how good we get it out here, it ain't no good if it ain't no good in here. I was very, very fortunate. I'll tell you, not that I wouldn't have liked to have had a lot of money when I first got sober. But God wouldn't let me. I think he was looking down and going, no, not Bob. No. Even when I was 12 years sober, and I was starting to get a little bit of material success, and I was starting to get some notoriety in the community, and I was starting to speak a bunch in AA, a guy came up to me. It was funny, because I try to be honest. And a guy came up to me, and he says, hey, all this stuff, aren't you afraid it's going to go to your head? I thought about it for a second. You know, I said to him, I said, well, where else would it go? I mean, really, where else would it go? If you're wired like I am, of course it's going to go to my head. So what's going to protect me from me? Got a sponsor. I have 2 commitments a week in the trenches. I have never stopped going down to Skid Row every week. And I've gone down there in a $100 car. And I've gone down there in a $200,000 car. I go down to Skid Row every week. And I work with drunks. Period. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I have money, if I don't have money. And I've been at places in my sobriety where I'm off. I've got too full of myself and had a lot of money and been depressed. And had no sense of not only material well-being, no sense of any kind of well-being. And had more money in the bank than I could ever spend. And then I've had times in early sobriety where I was paycheck to paycheck, struggling, really had nothing. And I was lit up. And I didn't worry about money. Because I knew God's taking care of me. And I had the material well-being. And I was struggling paycheck to paycheck, paying off amends and paying people back. And I was lit up. It's really, Chamberlain used to say, it's an inside job. It really is. So when we come back tonight, we're going to do the question and answer. And if we get through that early enough, we'll spend some of tonight on step 9, maybe a little bit more on 8. If not, we'll pick it up in the morning. We'll be back here at 8 o'clock sharp.